Blog Talk Radio.
Found the technical wizards here at Masonic Effects. Welcome. Welcome on this, the late in the year, 322nd day of the year. Unbelievable. Hard to believe. We only have 40 days left in the year. This is 6015 Anno Lumine. A wonderful day today. I look out behind me and It's snowing. It's the first respectable snow of the season. Just it reminds us of the constant process of change that's going on around us. I hope you've your week has been going well. It's been an interesting week on the face of the earth. Oh, is it news to anybody out there that we're experiencing some information flow and increase the information flow? Social media is wonderful. Remember that old adage, watch what you wish for because it might come true. Do you remember hearing that when you were a boy or a girl? Well, this is conversation, that need to communicate has been up until recently something that we've always been able to measure in terms of mouth to ear, more or less. Printing press, yes, we've been able to transfer ideas. A written word, of course, before that. But we're in accounts, of course, we like knowing, because they reveal things about our past that we otherwise wouldn't be able to retrieve. And in a way, it helps validate our sense of purpose and reason in the contemporary situation, what's going on around us today. But social media has eclipsed that, hasn't it? Not confusion, but the validation of what we've always suspected or always known, the truths that we were taught as children that have been unraveling around us. If we're that naive that we can only exist in the mind of a child, then I don't think there's much hope for a humanity. Not to say that in a stricter sense of childlike quality, it doesn't have its value and purpose in certain circumstances, under certain circumstances. I'm not talking in terms of absolutes. But what I am talking about is the understanding and asking the essential questions, the things that Freemasonry allows us to do. But, oh, here's a revelation, you know, here's an epiphany, not so much a revelation. an epiphany that I'm catching up with the audience of Masonic Effects. I know you're well read and way, way out there, way ahead of the humble offerings that we discuss here in the program. But what we're finding is that there are certain themes that are going on. By degrees, there are levels of atrocity. But, you know, when I look and go through the file banks from my mind and I look under atrocity, does it really matter? You know, what's the version today? Am I not aware of what an atrocity is? Or if I look under abomination, am I not aware? Or for that matter, if I look under in the dictionary under the terms zealots, I always think, well, that's sort of a synonym for dangerous. Some way, shape, or form, it usually ends up that way. But am I shocked? It's not news, not for a mature mind. It is exactly what it is. It is part of our nature. It may be an unpleasant part. It may be a countervalence. It may be the balance of all that youthful energy and impulsiveness and joie de vivre that occurs in early parts of life that some, through Freemasonry, want to continue on into the entire life cycle. We are experiencing things that, if we aren't regulated, if we don't modulate what's going on around us, I can see where weak-minded people can become quite overwhelmed and perplexed, nervous, frightful, close your door and lock your doors with double bolts, and create that illusion that you're safe. Dear, 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 dear. Safety is in the mind. Your capacity to understand what's going on around. As soon as that's suspended, as soon as a fellow gives up that, then it's not that the world is changing around him. He's just stopped, or as much as he thinks. Nobody has control over these processes. Nobody. So we can dumb it down and become stupid about it and try and run away. But nothing changes around us. Life goes on. In large part, it's the illusion. Sun comes up. Well, we know now sun doesn't come up. Earth is turning. Moons come up. Well, we know they're turning too. A lot of the things that we see as concrete surfaces are really are all molecules and full of little air and little spaces in between them. The neutrino is bombarding us wherever you are on the face of the earth, going right through us, going right through the earth on their journey from the that started at the face of the sun, are testament to that. Now, yeah, I don't have, the conversation doesn't make any sense if we want to go back and to me. And I think a lot of serious-minded people, and we want to go back and think that there are folks that believe in their heart of hearts that dinosaurs were walking around while mankind was on the earth. And for those folks, I say you're absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. But we in this country, we just came through a period where we had a leadership espousing the notion that politics, that the reason of man was had a greater priority, greater sense of impact, a sense of greater truth and purpose than science. Not that science alone is the bee's knees. Remember that one of the greatest abominations in the face of the earth was committed in the Second World War against the Japanese people when those hideous nuclear bombs were dropped. Despite 150 of the greatest scientists of the time, greatest minds, the physicists, sending a letter to Truman begging that he not release it. So what are you going to do? We learn a lesson about what? That put in the hands of people that lack an ethic, that do have the taste of blood, enjoy the taste of blood, that can rationalize that level of murder. Something's happened to the human spirit that needs to be modified. I don't know if it's a fix, it's an evolution. And it will. What happened then, I think, is a serious mutation. And one that any thinking person would realize can't continue or shouldn't continue. But nevertheless, it's out there. So I want to talk to you today. I think we have a pretty good program. We're bringing a pretty good program to you today. This is where I want to talk with you about where the true teaching comes from. The purpose, the confusion, all of the confusion around us in Freemasonry is about this effort for clarity, for clarification. If we're armed with them, we put in one pocket that the purpose is to follow the light, to replace ignorance with the insight, and that's the purpose. Well, it's easier, I think, for some minds to dumb that down or not even ask the question, what is it? What is it is this convivial group. But for some fellows that we have over the decades, they've come to think of the order, concrete thinkers, will come to think of the order as what they see at a meeting. Well-suited fellows sitting down to a banquet and developing, community charity events. And for them, that's the expression of Freemasonry. There is nothing more. And that, again, as we were speaking about in a previous program, is one of the elements that creates a balance within Freemasonry. Is this the intention? Well, hard to know, because we have the histrionic historians that will tell us that everything about Freemasonry, the strength of it, was in its past. And perhaps if by that you're talking about the proof, a philosophical proof that was in the past, then we could agree. Because in that statement, there's no expression that Freemasonry was stagnant or has stopped evolving or growing, or that it's not multifaceted or wasn't in the first place. I believe the things that are going on around us in varying proportions were happening from the beginning, from the 14th to 15th centuries, and perhaps, and likely much longer than that, beyond what we could document, questions about ourselves in relation to larger influences. So the way it's posed today is the world does the teaching. If we want to learn, a man learns for himself or he doesn't. At an early age, we teach our children the basic forms of literacy. Reading and writing are important tools to function as an adult. Children already know how to communicate. As a child grows, capability becomes known to us by behavior. A bright child behaves differently. That's not always encouraged by the adults around the child. Personality and intelligence is defined as we grow. Although we ascribe all kinds of things, we'll say that a child is smiling. New parents looking at an infant. Well, we know, infants can't focus their eyes. The notion of a smile is something that's cause and effect. And yet we ascribe these qualities and characteristics because they're consistent with meeting our needs. The child is influenced by the atmospheres experienced, intended and otherwise. Need and opportunity influence what a person does. I think that's valid, don't you? Opportunity. We don't live in a world that's equal. Opportunity is not equal. And success does not just come because people work hard and are diligent. There are many, many people who are diligent and work hard and have good ideas, and they're not necessarily successful in a material sense. So Freemasonry takes us in a different direction to define success in terms of an inner state of tranquility or an inner state of satisfaction. Experience can shape the way a person connects with the world around. When does the mind leave behind the frivolity of youth isn't clear. When does that happen? For some, it is early. For others, it is a gradual process. I don't mean the person at 40 is trying to act like he's 20. I mean in a different sense. Asking, you sit down with a serious-minded 20-year-old, you sit down with a fool that's 60. You decide who's the youth, where it is. The principles and philosophy of Freemasonry cannot be imposed on anyone. The initiation makes that abundantly clear. Of my own free will and accord. Experience can shape us and the way we connect with the world around. When does the mind leave certain states? The principles and philosophy. It is when the mentoring occurs that a more cultured mind becomes accessible to the apprentice. Where are the mentors? The mentor is not necessarily something abstract. It can be part of the mentoring process, but the mentor is that complex event in a person's life. Of somebody being committed to guide, to teach, to support, to help the apprentice learn their capability, learn just how good how much talent they have. The history of Freemasonry lets us know there are expectations of a manner to one another and to others, acts of philanthropy and charity, to not brag or assume propriety, to be generous of spirit, quick to forgive, willing to entertain the dissenting opinion, easy in manner. Poking at a man with ideas has probably done more to discourage learning than any other function. Because doesn't that process make us all seem inadequate and foolish? What's the point? Observations of the world, aude vide tace. Listen, watch, in silence. Be an observer of the world if the goal is to learn. The world includes other people, transactions, events large and small. Some rules that exist at a macro level do not follow through at a micro level. Rules that apply when something's very large don't necessarily follow through when we're looking at very small objects. So a little bit of granularity in the conversation today. I want to, we'll come back. We're just going to have a listen to a little Grappelli Reinhardt, 80 South. And this is just a little short to ditty from swing style in the 30s, I think, about 1936. Check it out. Thank you. lovely little toe tapper in the morning. It's or midday. What do we learn? Do we learn very much? We learn as we pay attention that it's not how much dogs in the fight, it's how much fights in the dog. How determined, how stubborn in a way. It's important that if we become determined to be making our decisions based on things that are valid. It's remarkable. I've been sharing with you bits and pieces of the history of Britain. Not always flattering, but it's because we know so much that it's hard to dismiss some of the events, because a lot of the history was passed down orally, and it reveals more about the thinking of people and the position in politics. Said they, in 1639, remember the Covenanters, they were saying the covenant is between the people and God, not the king. They said, but Charlie, if you're going to impose your prayer book in Scotland, remember Jenny threw her little stool at the priest and caused all kinds of hell, it's like over my dead body, you know, that kind of stuff. They said, well, you can try it, but you're going to need 40,000 men to do it. So a fellow named Edward Hyde wrote, a small scarce discernible cloud arose in the north, which was shortly after attended with such a storm that even rooted up the greatest and tallest cedars of the three nations, blasted all its beauty and fruitfulness, brought its strength to decay and its glory to reproach. Richelieu quickly spotted the little cloud. He saw an opportunity to promote the interests of France by supporting the Scots against Charles. Robert de Moray was promoted to lieutenant colonel in the Scots Guard and dispatched to Scotland. His instruction, to assist the revolt against Charles. So Patrick Gordon traced Richelieu's plan like this. Wherefore Cardinal Richelieu, choosing forth a man fit for his purpose amongst the many of the Scots gentry that haunted the French court, he chose forth one, Robert Moray, a man endowed with sundry rare qualities and a very able man for the cardinal's project. Think about what I've just read. The gentry, the Scottish gentry that were in and around the French court, that haunted the French court. And then think of Scottish right. I digress. The Covenanters have been fortunate. That reminds me. I need to do something about the history of York Masonry. Just not to be unkind, but to be realistic. Covenanters have been fortunate in obtaining the service of a very experienced soldier, Sir Alexander Leslie. He just came back from Scotland after spending 30 years in the army of the King of Sweden. He was 60. He signed the covenant and was immediately placed at the head of the Covenanters' army. He saw Moray's engineering skills as a distinct military asset and promptly gave him the post of quartermaster general. The duties were to assign quarters and to supply weaponry to the army. He was also in charge of building and laying out fortifications and camps. So Moray's knowledge of surveying and mathematics and civil engineering became invaluable. Alexander Hamilton was the Covenanters' general of artillery, and he worked closely with Moray and introduced Moray to Freemasonry. Hamilton was a member of the Lodge of Edinburgh, having been initiated in Edinburgh on the 20th of May, 1640. Alexander Hamilton, in turn, had been initiated by James Hamilton and John Mill. The networking between the Scottish nobility was starting to become interesting. Hamilton was the third Marquess of Hamilton, and at the time was supporting Argyll. He had been Charles I's advisor on religion, but had resigned in 1638. James Hamilton served with the Covenanters' army against Stafford, although he would not sign the covenant himself. Eventually, he left Leslie and in 1643 went to Oxford to try to join the king and persuade him to do a deal with the Scots. John Mahon, the grandson of the mason who initiated James VI into the Lodge of Scone in Perth, had himself initiated Lord Alexander of Stirling, Charles I's Secretary of State for Scotland, into the Lodge of Edinburgh on the 3rd of July, 1634. The following July, he had initiated Anthony Alexander, Charles I's Master of Works, and on the 27th of December, 1637, he had initiated David Ramsay, Royal Clockmaker and Gentleman of the Bedchamber for Charles. John Milne was certainly well connected with the Scottish nobility, and when he initiated Alexander Hamilton, he began to extend his links into the officers of the Covenanter army. But in May 1641, Moray was encamped in Newcastle with the rest of Leslie's army. So he had gone south and over to the east coast. He was approached by General Hamilton and asked if he would like to become a Freemason. Hamilton must have explained that, as well as himself, the Marquis of Hamilton was already a Mason and would be conducting the ceremony alongside the army's master builder, John Milne, who would have reported to Moray in his position as quartermaster general. By the end of the evening, Moray would have been known that many Scottish nobles were Freemasons. Moray agreed to join. And on the evening of 20 May 1641, James Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, and John Milne brought together these four other Freemasons and convened a lodge to initiate Robert Moray. A minute was produced of the initiation and returned to the Lodge of Edinburgh. Comparing the signatures of James Hamilton and John Milne, they're exactly the same as those on the record of Alexander's initiation, exactly a year earlier. Alexander Hamilton had signed with his Mason's mark an equilateral triangle. Likewise, Robert Moray had signed his name with a Mason's mark, a five-pointed star. He was now a fellow of the craft and so entitled to his own Mason's mark. Imagine the voice of the Marquis of Hamilton telling him, "Brother Moray, we congratulate you on your preferment. You are to judge with candor, admonish with friendship, and reprehend with mercy." I was to discover that he remembered and applied these sentiments for the rest of his life. But the phrase that had the most impact on our future and on his future behavior was, "You are to contemplate the intellectual faculties and to trace them in their development through the paths of nature and science, even to the throne of God himself." This idea would grow in his mind until it finally blossomed in the form of the Royal Society. In one of his letters to Alexander Bruce, written just before the Restoration, he said, "Many such things have befallen me in my life, which have given me so intimate an acquaintance with God's goodness and such feelings, that I have much need to thank him, besides the good I am indebted to him in the several dispensations, for stooping so far as to give me so many pregnant, sensible experiments for confirming my faith and his truth." Robert Moray left the Covenanter's army at the end of 1642 and traveled south. On the 10th January 1643, he attended the court of Charles I in Oxford. I was aware of this fact because it is on that day Charles knighted him. Why Charles chose to knight Moray is a puzzle. Moray's mission had been to promote the Scottish cause in order to make trouble for England at the advantage of France. He would not at first sight seem to be an obvious candidate for the favor of the beleaguered king in England. But there was another factor to take into account. Cardinal Richelieu, Moray's patron and spy master, had died on the 4th of December, 1642. Charles knighted Moray exactly 37 days later. there was adequate time for Moray to have received the news of Richelieu's death, now that he had lost his French patron. Was it possible that Moray had decided to change sides? Indeed, was Robert Moray the passenger who told Charles of the death of Richelieu? And is this why he traveled down from Newcastle to Oxford? Richelieu's death would have allowed Queen Henrietta Maria's brother, the 41-year-old Louis XIII, to abandon Richelieu's anti-Huguenot policy and make it possible for him to support his sister's husband in the battles with the Puritan Parliament, Catholics supporting the Protestants. Moray still held a commission as a lieutenant colonel in Louis' personal bodyguard when he returned to Paris soon after receiving his knighthood. Remember that part, personal bodyguard. Did he carry a message to Louis from Charles? I mentioned this scenario in a conversation with Robert Cooper, the librarian of the Grand Lodge of Edinburgh. Robert added the comment that if Charles used Moray as a messenger, then he certainly would have knighted him to make certain his message was given a proper status by his French brother-in-law. I cannot prove this hypothesis, but the fact that on his return to Paris, Sir Robert was immediately promoted to a full colonel and Louis' personal bodyguard tends to support the idea that his status had been deliberately increased in order that he could carry an important message to the French king. It was unfortunate for Charles that Louis died soon after and so was not able to assist him. Toward the end of 1643, Moray returned to active duty with his regiment of Scots Guard fighting in Bavaria. He was unlucky enough to be captured in a prison and spent the next 15 months sitting in a Bavarian prison cell, studying magnetism and corresponding with the German scientist Curtius. Then, after nearly 2 years of imprisonment, he was suddenly ransomed by the French. And on the 28th of April, 1645, Sir Robert was freed on the payment of £16,500 by Cardinal Mazarin. He returned to France, which again wished to exploit the differences between king and parliament in England. Louis XIII had died soon after Sir Robert had been imprisoned. France was now ruled by Queen Anne of Austria. She was the mother of the young King Louis XIV and Cardinal Mazarin. Charles had lost the city of Bristol, and having few options left to him, had opened up discussions with the Covenanters. Moray's old commander, General Alexander Leslie, now the Earl of Leven, was the main negotiator. Back and forth. So we see how the gentry was part and parcel of the flow of information between leaders of the day, conveying the ambitions of the moment. What difference then that some person with an smartphone takes pictures of an event or a video of an event and instantly sends it to the internet instantly, the only censorship being the eye of the beholder. We still weren't there, but we can see a representation from a particular angle, a snapshot of an event. We don't see the overall, if anybody ever does. And we don't necessarily see the outcome, as if anybody ever really does. But we're given these pictures so that it, rather than somebody else forming our opinions for us and telling us about them, we're able to do that for ourselves. Now, the question for us as Masons, is this going to change the way we go about collecting news? Well, obviously. We like to hear the opinions of other people when they agree with us. We like that, especially when we can say something outrageous because we're not accountable for it. We can comment on things we know very little about. Oh my, we're just like the masses. Oh, we seem to be part of the masses. The populist opinion, the court of public trial, where we can determine guilt based on the looks of a person. How 17th century of us. The progress that we claim to make needs to be shown in our manner. And I think that it's always possible that we show ourselves. You think about the instructions that were given to Moray. The instruction of masonry, the construct that we're taught, allows us at any given moment to be different than the mob. If we extend justice with mercy, if we carry ourselves with a dignity and think about the Mason in the man, this world brotherhood, and we do that in 18th century as well as we do that in the 21st century, it's been constant, then throughout history, men that, with that carriage will always present them as a head above the rest. Always. Always that goal. Always that measure against injustice. It's always been the same. It's always been reason. And now we're seeing in North America that we're dismantling capital punishment because we realize how many times we're killing innocent people. Bloodlust will do that. We just want a killing. And we see in the so-called news, we see that all the time. And we, as jurors in the world courts, in the public courts, are able to pass judgment simply because we're asked guilt or innocence, not because we know anything about it. How about we begin by having a conversation about our ethics and whether the ethics that we have in our mind are conveyed to, are shown in the decisions that we make? What good are the obligations if we don't use them, if we don't deploy them? You can see almost why and how the thinkers of the day would be embracing occult ideas. Not just the convention of social life, but the edge of science, the edge of reason, a review of our very sense of reality, like we would if we became students of the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah allows us to do that. The secret teachings of the ages, the occult and the esoteric, allow us to do that. Alchemy allows us to do that. So if we're using the measure of hard science, as we know hard science today, a distortion, if you will, from what it was in the past, then these things have been marginalized. But once, not so very long ago, they were being taken up by very serious-minded people. So we might want to ask ourselves what's in them. If they're that valuable, that genius of the past would seriously entertain them, what are we missing? But it was Abraham Maslow said that to the man who only has a hammer, everything he encounters begins to look like a nail. What we think or what we do or what we believe is in the end of little consequence. The only consequence is what we do. John Ruskin said that. Sometimes we write down these ideas, we pass them on, because the mind that created them was speaking for us and to us. Like this from Marcel Proust. The real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new lands, but seeing with new eyes. And the anonymous among us said, work like you don't need money, love like you've never been hurt, and dance like no one's watching. Here. A little bit of Miles Davis, and then we'll move on. What's not to like is Miles Davis. What is not to like? That's Miles Davis. Where do we go? You can see, I think, how we began drawing out curiosity, knowing that really the rapprochements within our initiations don't come as new. What's new? The ideas have been implanted. But what is new? It's somebody saying that now that should be a goal in life. Only the very privileged men around us, men and women around us, would have the benefit of an insightful scholar or intellectual giving us these kind of guideposts to help us navigate through life. This is, after all, the point. This is continuing on our series of good poetry. This is something by Peter Porter, an exequy. And this is read by Ian McEwan. have a listen. I think you'll appreciate it.
I've chosen Peter Porter, the Exequeep. Porter's wife, Janice, killed herself in her childhood attic bedroom in 1974. And the elegy he wrote some months later is perhaps the finest in modern poetry. It borrows its form from Henry King's 17th century lament for the death of his young wife, who's called The Exequy. And Peter, with very typical modesty, calls his An Exequy. These are four beat lines, tetrameters, mostly end stopped, and they have a funereal quality, heavy with grief, reminding us of King's famous couplet. But hark, my pulse, like a soft drum, beats my approach, tells thee I come. But where Henry King writes in the conventional expectation of reconciliation in the afterlife, Peter Porter's poem is troubled by guilt. In wet May, in the months of change, in a country you wouldn't visit, strange dreams pursue me in my sleep, black creatures of the upper deep. Though you are 5 months dead, I see you in guilt's iconography. Dear wife, lost beast, beleaguered child, the stranded monster with the mild appearance, whom small waves tease, Andromeda upon her knees in orthodox deliverance. And you alone of pure substance, the unformed form of life, the earth which Piero's brushes brought to birth for all to greet as myth, a thing out of the box of imagining. This introduction serves to sing your mortal death as Bishop King once hymned in tetrametric rhyme his young wife, lost before her time. Though he lived on for many years, his poem each day fed new tears to that unreaching spot, her grave. His lines, a Baroque architrave, the Sunday poor with bottled flowers would bypass in their morning hours, esteeming ragged natural life, most dearly loved, most gentle wife. Yet looking back, when at the gate and seeing grief in formal state upon a sculpted angel group, were glad that men of God could stoop to give the dead a public stance and freeze them in their mortal dance. The words and faces proper to my misery are private. You would never share your heart with those whose only talents to suppose, nor from your final childish bed raise a remote confessing head. The channels of our lives are blocked, the hand is stopped upon the clock. No one can say why hearts will break and marriages are all opaque. A map of loss, some posted cards, the living house reduced to shards, the abstract hell of memory, the pointlessness of poetry. These are the instances which tell of something which I know full well. I owe a debt to you. One day the time will come for me to pay, when your slim shape from photographs stands at my door and gently asks if I have any work to do, or will I come to bed with you? O Scala Enigmata, I'll climb up to that attic where the curtain of your life was drawn sometime between despair and dawn. I'll never know with what halt steps you mounted to this plain eclipse, but each stair now will station me a black responsibility and point me to that shut down room. This be your due appointed tomb. I think of us in Italy, gin and Chianti fueled, we moved in a trance through paradise, feeding at last our starving eyes to people of the English blindness, doing each masterpiece the kindness of discovering it, from Baldo Vinetti to Venice's most obscure jetty. A true unfortunate traveller, I depend upon your nurse's eye to pick the altars where no grinner puts us off our tourist dinner, and in hotels to bandy words with Genevan girls and talking birds, to wear your feet out following me to night's end and true amity. and call my rational fear of flying a paradigm of holy dying. And oh, my love, I wish you were once more with me at night somewhere in narrow streets applauding wines. The moon above the Apennines, as large as logic, and the stars, most middle-aged of avatars, as bright as when they shone for truth upon untried and avid youth. The rooms and days we wandered through shrink in my mind to one. There you lie, quite absorbed by peace. The calm which life could not provide is balm in death. Unseen by me, you look past bed and stairs and half-read book eternally upon your home. The end of pain, the left alone. I have no friend, no intercessor, no psychopomp or true confessor, but only you who know my heart in every cramped and devious path. Then take my hand and lead me out. The sky is overcast by doubt. The time has come. I listen for your words of comfort at the door. Oh, guide me through the shoals of fear. Fürchte dich nicht, ich bin bei dir.
Worthy praise for his dead wife. Worthy praise. Remember, to wrap up today, I want to just whisper in your ear a little bit some of the things that you've been telling me. We're celebrating, I guess, the birth of Charles I. I think it was on the 19th of November in the Kingdom of Fife in Scotland. Yeah. Kingdom of Fife. Up in the northern parts of Scotland, in the Highlands. Interesting times we're in. Principles of Freemasonry, I need to remind, are timeless. That's not something that's affected by you or I. Whether you think that the strength of Freemasonry is in the past, or as I do, that the potential for Freemasonry is greater in the future than it has ever been, you have your own legitimate opinion, perspective. But remember that the principles are timeless. You and I can abuse them, neglect them, ignore them. But they are ideas, and they endure through the centuries and through great adversity. The Soviet Union fell on the Christmas Day in 1991. Some of you will remember that. Freemasonry had been outlawed in Russia for more than 70 years. But by 1994, the new Grand Lodge of Russia had been formed. Very gradually, Masonry came back in the Ukraine and Hungary and Moldova, Romania, up in Bulgaria and over to Armenia and Georgia and even Azerbaijan. And it went further into Eastern Europe. In Yugoslavia, no greater symbol of tolerance than the formation of Masonic lodges. That was where the state was designed to control and provide for the day-to-day needs of society. And the notion of voluntarism had become extinct. Freemasonry is helping to bring back the idea of neighbor helping neighbor. Sadly, Freemasonry still has enemies. The Ukrainian parliament recently became close to adopting laws that would sentence any government official who became a Mason to up to 7 years in prison. And for private citizens, it would have been 3 years in prison. Crazy-ass Ukrainian government. Meanwhile, the Russian society is still suspicious, almost entirely because of the fictitious propaganda known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But it continues to expand in a free world with free thinkers. And it's growing throughout the world. at its most basic level, Masonry provides its members with a place to go for a while to escape the strife and struggle of the outside world. I always thought that it was a privilege. That was the quiet, reverent privilege of a lodge, not the mocking that occurred when some fellows tried to turn it into a locker room. That was insulting, more revealing of their nature and crassness than needed to be said or reflected. But Freemasonry survives, always waiting to be rediscovered. So if there has been a downturn or futility or frustration in your experience around the lodge, let it go. Don't let your pride get in the way. Find the place within Masonry, another place. There's more than one. It always retains its character, and so do you. And it's always adapting some of its 18th century practices to the 21st century. So I leave you today with a message. Thank you for tuning in, but rediscover Masonry. Rediscover and expose the next generation to the principles and values of the order as they were intended to be taught. If you do this, this will, in a sense, reinvent the future of the craft by drawing on the past. The universal brotherhood is around us. It's around us, and it's with us, and it's through us. And inevitably, Freemasonry is not an organization or governments or a constitution. It is you. I look forward to seeing you real soon. Enjoy the snow. Enjoy the weather here in Canada. Here's a little Horace Silver from the trio from 1968. See you. Oh, he was in Denmark at the time. Come back soon. Thanks for supporting the program. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.